Thousands of homeowners will soon be losing their homeowner insurance. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Three large companies are ending their policies in Florida just as hurricane season's about to start. Some of it is due to losses from Irma and Matthew, but a lot of it is because of fraud. Also,
part of our mission at Miami-Dade College is to be accessible, and in order to be accessible, you have to be affordable.
Miami-Dade College, like many higher ed institutions around the country, is struggling to enroll and retain. Black students are dropping out at alarming rates. We'll hear from the president about their plans to change course. And finally, a look inside an immigration detention center and how lawyers work to help immigrants navigate the system. All of that today on Sundial. After the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Preparing for this hurricane season just got tougher for thousands of homeowners. Days before the official start of hurricane season, forecasters are predicting 17 named storms. It's likely to be busier than usual. Now, beginning this week and through June 6, Floridians can stock up on hurricane necessities tax-free. That's under a new law signed by Governor DeSantis. But three large insurance companies are dropping tens of thousands of customers from their home insurance policies. The Miami Herald's Renee Rodriguez has more on this story, and he joins us now. Renee, these groups are canceling the policies just as hurricane season's about to begin. First of all, which are these companies?
There's three companies. They're all based in Florida, although one of them is actually owned by a Puerto Rican company. But they are Universal Insurance Company of North America, which is the one that's active in South Florida. And the other two are Southern Fidelity Insurance Company. And the third is Gulfstream Property and Casualty Insurance Company.
And how many policies in all are being canceled?
There's a total of more than 53,000 policies. Now, that sounds like a lot, but it doesn't. Down in South Florida, we're talking about roughly 2,000 or so policies, because Fidelity and Gulfstream concentrate in North and Central Florida.
Hmm. Now, my understanding, right, is that insurance companies, when they want to change rates or coverage or anything like that, I mean, they have to go through the state. What's the process?
So in January 1st and May 1st of every year, insurance companies can go through the Florida Office of Insurance Regulation and state their financials. So they look at what they have in pocket, they look at what they've made in profit, and they look at what they owe in claims, and they can say, look, we're not going to have enough money to pay for claims if a hurricane hits this year. And even though there were no hurricanes that hit Florida directly in 2020, we're coming off a very active three-year period. And these three companies realized that their bottom lines did not make sense.
And is it the last few years? I'm wondering, what is it that these companies are saying, are the reasons, the main reasons why they're having to drop these all these policies?
Well, for example, Universal, which does operate throughout the state, has more outstanding debt than it does income. So in 2020, they lost $22.5 million. And those were claims that came from the previous 3 years. They didn't come in 2020. And in 2019, they lost $4.1 million. And you have to remember that a lot of these companies also operate in other coastal states. They're not just in Florida. So they also insure in Georgia, Louisiana, South Carolina, Texas. And so what they anticipate is we're not going to be able to pay claims if a hurricane hits. So they're being proactive by canceling these policies.
So how much of the losses that these companies are claiming is because of storms, but how much of it is because of fraudulent claims?
That's the question, right? So it used to be you had up to 3 years. So for example, Irma blows through, right? And it damages your roof. But you don't realize that Irma has damaged your roof until a year later when there's a huge storm and all of a sudden you discover a leak in your roof, and you have an adjuster come out and they tell you, oh, this is hurricane damage. It used to be you had up to 3 years to file a claim based on hurricane damage. Now it's the Florida legislation has shortened that to 2 years, but there are still a lot of fraudulent claims. You know, someone whose roof starts to leak, which had nothing to do with a hurricane, can be like, oh, let's just blame this on Irma and have the insurance company foot the bill. And so the insurance company won't necessarily pay for it, but they have to pay for attorneys to fight that claim in court. So a lot of it has to do with litigation and attorney's fees.
Do we have any idea like what percentage of what most of these insurance companies face is because of fraud?
We don't have an exact percentage because it varies from company to company. Even adjusters. So for example, after a hurricane comes, the public adjuster who comes to your house and assesses your damage can only charge a maximum of 10% to the insurance company. So if your damage is, let's say, $100,000, they could only tack on $10,000 as their fee for the first calendar year. But in the second calendar year, they can come back and say, oh, it's actually 30%. The laws are so vague in there, and the insurance companies are left out to hang. So even though the companies themselves are the ones that are often painted as the villains, they're not doing this because they want to. They're doing this because they have to.
We're speaking with the Miami Herald's Renee Rodriguez. Again, the headline, tens of thousands of Floridians are set to lose their flood insurance, their homeowner insurance, policies beginning June 1st, just as we approach hurricane season. And you could read more of his reporting on this. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. And I have to be careful when I say that, too, because there's a difference between your property policy and flood insurance. And that's sometimes where people get in trouble, right?
That's right. Like homeowner insurance policies do not cover flood. They cover windstorm damage. They cover everything else. But you have to have a separate flood insurance policy because that has to do with where your home is located. How prone to floods are you? If every homeowner policy included flood insurance, none of us would have a policy.
Well, there's also, and the story too, that they are reworking those flood maps. So, flood insurance could be going up soon for a lot of people. You know, we were lucky, even though 2020 was a very busy season, we were very lucky not to be hit by Mother Nature. But, you know, these losses, as you mentioned, they go back to Hurricane Matthew, Hurricane Irma. I'm wondering right now, how are insurance companies viewing doing business in South Florida? Has it just become a bit too risky?
Well, they all have their fingers crossed that we get 3 years of no hurricanes. We're down to one, right? Because they want to do business here. It's not that they don't want to. It's just that they have to limit their exposure. There are several big companies like Allstate and Geico who have started insurance for condo policies, which is something they had stopped several years ago. And they do that by using what they call PUP companies, which is a smaller company that is owned by Allstate but has limited exposure. Now, condos are easier to insure because it's a condo. It's not a home. So you see the insurance companies are interested in insuring here. I mean, the real estate market here is still so thriving. There's a lot of profit to be made. But they have to be very, very careful that they can live up to the claims if a devastating Cat 5 storm hit here.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing too is there's Citizens Property Insurance, and that's the state-backed insurer. Now, I know going back that, you know, former Governor Scott was trying to get people off of that, but it seems like more and more people are going back to it, right?
That's right. Like Governor Scott, at one point, Citizens had 1.5 million policies, which is just ridiculous. And we all pay for Citizens. Any insurance policy that you have, whether it's medical insurance, your car insurance, the only two types of policies that are excluded are malpractice, medical malpractice, and workman's comp. But if you look at your insurance bill for any other insurance, you will see there is a percentage assessed that goes to Citizens Property. And that's the only way that Citizens Property can continue to insure new homeowners, especially in such a red hot real estate market.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned that, you know, it is a great market right now, and seems like more people are still moving down here. But I mean, not just the threat of hurricanes, obviously the issues with climate change and sea level rise. What do experts say about Florida, South Florida especially, when it comes to insurance and how they view the future?
Well, Citizens is a backstop, right? I mean, it's there. And let's say that we get hit by a Cat 3 this year. Your premium on your auto insurance and your medical insurance will go up to fund Citizens because they cover so many policies. But their current number right now is about 700,000, which is about a little less than half what it was when Rick Scott, you know, called the code red and said, you know, we have to do something about, you know, depopulating Citizens, which is what they, the term that they use to kind of distribute other policies. But as of right now, Citizens cannot fail because it's funded by us. We all pay for it, whether we use it or not. And thank God for them, because otherwise the real estate market here would be in deep trouble.
Such an interesting story. Feeling very bad for a lot of people who might be losing their coverage. Not sure what to do at this point. We're coming up on hurricane season. Again, talking with the Miami Herald's Renee Rodriguez. Read more of his reporting on this on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Renee, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Lewis.
Well, still to come. Normally in a tough job market, people go back to school. Why is the opposite happening now? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The pandemic has impacted people going to college or technical schools. Many are dropping out or not even enrolling. Across the country, colleges are missing more than 500,000 students, and community colleges have been impacted the most. Miami-Dade College started the year with a drop in enrollment of 17%. Now, they're hoping to make a full recovery to the pre-pandemic enrollment by this summer. Yesterday, we spoke with the college's president, Madeline Pumariega, about their new recruitment ideas and the long-term implications that this is going to have on higher education. But first, we started by talking about how a decline in enrollment has affected the school's finances.
You know, it's impacted dramatically in terms of just the revenue. About 50% of our revenue comes from tuition and fees. But fortunately, with the federal stimulus dollars, that lets you do some of your revenue replacement. So we've been able to weather this dip in enrollment, which isn't typical. Usually when the economy goes down, enrollment soars. But never have we gone in the last 100 years through a worldwide pandemic. And so we now know that when a health crisis hits America, it has an impact on academic programs and enrollment at our colleges.
When you were offered the job as president of Miami-Dade College, you pledged not to increase tuition considering the challenges you're facing. Is that still a promise you can keep?
It's still a promise that I can keep. I think that it's so important, especially right now when our community, so many in our community are hurting economically, to know that there's not a financial barrier for them to be able to send their kids to college or come back and finish that degree or start that college credit certificate. And so as long as I can do it, that's my pledge, because part of our mission at Miami-Dade College is to be accessible. And in order to be accessible, you have to be affordable, high quality, and have programs that lead to jobs.
So I want to look at the legislative session from this past year. Lawmakers signed off on a record state budget. They agreed on new tuition breaks for college students, but they did cut $600 from textbook stipends that will affect 80,000 Bright Futures recipients. From this past session, what did you see that concerned you that could impact your low-income students in particular?
In terms of the Bright Futures students and the book stipend, we really don't get in a large number of Bright Future students, but we would work with those students to make sure that we took care of their textbooks if they fell short and they were low income and didn't have that coverage, so it wouldn't be as a barrier. I am optimistic of what I saw during the legislative session on the focus of workforce, the real modernization of workforce programs across our university colleges and working closely with CareerSource. So I think that helps our low-income students, it helps our community make sure that we're aligning our academic programs to the jobs that are out there. And we did get a small PICO allocation for construction to finish up the project at the West Campus for about $1.6 million. So we're hoping to bring that home as well and be able to finish off a space on that campus that would help students and faculty engage and add additional classrooms.
You know, I'm thinking about what you said a moment ago, that usually in a recession, we tend to see, an increase in enrollment, but this is a pandemic and a recession. And so we saw behavior change. You've been on the job for a short period of time, but, you know, you took it in the middle of this pandemic. And I'm wondering for you, what did you expect was going to happen as you came in, and how are things playing out? And again, this is a pandemic that none of us have ever been through, so we don't really know.
You know, I'm an internal optimist. So at some level, I, you know, had hope and the optimism that we were going to get on the other end of this pandemic. And certainly the year started out tough, and then we saw just the vaccinations readily available. We've seen the kind of low positivity rate in our community. Just saw that this morning once again through the mayor's office. You know, I expected what I've seen. We are a resilient community and we're a resilient college. I've seen individuals at our colleges working harder to meet student needs, our faculty reinvent curriculum to put it in a virtual environment. We are the community's college. We're the community's partner, and that's what I have seen every day, whether we were trying to keep our students safe, we were launching a care initiative at the college, or connecting to industry partners to provide opportunities for students.
Talking about enrollment issues, the Miami Herald's editorial board recently published a piece about the alarming numbers of local Black students dropping out of Miami-Dade College. How is the college addressing this issue?
It's a national issue. When we see the declines in enrollment, we saw across the country, and it was true for our community in Miami-Dade County, with the largest population being Hispanics, we saw declines there. But what we did see was a trend even before the pandemic. Our community is about 17% Black. Our student enrollment is around 15%. I want to close that gap. I want to make sure that our college is reflective of the community. When we looked at some course success rates in the fall, we noticed that some of our Black students were not as successful as we would have wanted them to be. And so we launched the Rising Black Scholars to make sure that our students in Miami-Dade County Public Schools and our schools across the district know that they have a place right here at Miami-Dade College to continue with their post-secondary work. We know that in this knowledge economy, having a credential beyond high school is going to be so important to be competitive. And that's what we want to make sure, is that we provide economic mobility for everyone in our community, but especially our Black scholars.
And could you tell me about this Rising Black Scholars program briefly?
Yes, it's a full scholarship, 60 credits at Miami-Dade College. It includes tuition and fees. It will also have a mentorship component where students will have the opportunity to be mentored by someone at the college and community leaders. And it also includes a leadership component, making sure that they also have access to leadership and entrepreneurship skills, which we believe really are future-proof. Those transcend any pandemic, those types of skills that we know create successful students and successful employees.
I'm speaking with Miami-Dade College President Madeline Pumariega. The college started the year with a drop in enrollment of 17%. They're hoping to make a full recovery to pre-pandemic enrollment by this summer. We're talking about new recruitment ideas and the long-term implications this will have on higher education and the economy. You can find more information on this story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I'm going to come back to the Rising Black Scholars Program, and sounds like a great program for high school graduates, but what happens to those MDC students that you lost because of the pandemic? Is there an effort to go reach out to them and try to get them back?
Yes, we have an effort with financial incentive programs. So we're helping those students that we lost come back by offering them scholarship opportunities as well as support. So we are, that is underway. That's where I think that we recovered a lot of our enrollment, were individuals that we started to old school, you know, call and text and email, offer orientation sessions. And we see that those are a lot of our returning students coming back.
You know, but do we know, do we have an answer as to why we're seeing a drop in Black students, why they're either not applying or just dropping out? Do we know why?
You look at the pandemic, it's fairly well documented who's been hurt and impacted the most in terms of loss of jobs. When we reached out to students who had not come back, you know, we heard three things. Number one, economically, they had lost their jobs or their jobs had changed and they just couldn't fit school into a schedule. The second was health. They were taking care of someone older, they were, you know, concerned for the health of their family, especially when they're living in a multi-generational home. And the third aspect in some cases is that they were taking care of a sibling or, you know, in general, childcare per se. And so those are the reasons that kept students back from re-enrolling. And we're hoping to remove some of those barriers, especially the financial barriers and the academic and student support.
You know, I'm wondering, you know, with colleges and universities, I mean, sometimes the expense and MDC, obviously not the expense that other schools may be, but still an expense for some people. And obviously the time that it takes, you know, how much time a student may have to work on their degree. Are higher ed institutions maybe not catering to these communities? Is it time to reexamine perhaps what we're offering?
Yes, I think it is. This is why we launched in January MDC Live. Live stands for learning interactively in a virtual environment. And as I said, students could take a course via Zoom, engaging with a faculty member and their peers. And that does minimize their transportation time. It allows a student who might be working to be able during an hour break to take a course and not have to maybe travel or if they have transportation barriers as well. So I think that's important. The 8-week semesters that we've created, you could start in January. You could also start in March. Now you could start in May, but we'll also have semesters that will start in June and July. I think that level of flexibility. And I think the third component is making sure that students see what the value of investing in a higher education credential is right now. Whether they're working on a 2+2 and they're going to transfer to FIU or UM or Barry, one of our universities, or whether they're in a workforce program and they're going to earn that credential and go straight to work. Again, those areas of healthcare are certainly programs that we're seeing increased enrollment. Technology as well, whether it's cloud computing, Amazon Web Services certificates, and industry certifications that let them position themselves to secure that entry-level job or get that promotion.
You know, and I talk about, you know, maybe changing up the offerings. I mean, we had seen that some members of the Black community, other minority groups, turning now to technical and vocational schools instead. What are your thoughts on that? And maybe, again, back to whatever the offerings are that maybe you have.
I think that not only the vocational programs where we call in Florida career technical education and have partnered with the Florida Department of Education on the Get There campaign, which offers a series of career tech ed programs. Not only, again, those trades, but also healthcare short-term programs, business and innovation and technology short-term programs. I think that industry certifications that lead to employment are really the new career tech ed, if you will, the new vocational. For example, we are the college leading Florida with industry certifications in cloud computing. Our Amazon Web Services certificates are also incredibly popular. I think the whole rollout of artificial intelligence and how it's going to change the way that we learn, the way that we live, certainly the way that we play. And I just saw something, the way that we sleep. And so also all of the AI certifications, incredibly popular for students interested in getting one of those certifications to get into that tech space.
That was Miami-Dade College President Madeline Pumariega. You can find links to more stories on this topic on our social media at WLRN Sundial. We're continuing the conversation about the pandemic's effects on higher education, specifically how it's affected low-income students. Again, colleges are experiencing a massive decline in enrollment. So some students are opting for technical schools, a more affordable education option. Joining us now is Anthony King Blackman. He's the founder of Blackman Music Group. He's also working with Miami-Dade Technical Colleges. Anthony, great to have you back.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Definitely. Also joining us is Jasmine Dominguez. She's a recent graduate from D.A. Dorsey Technical College. Jasmine, thank you for the time.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Jasmine, I wanted to start with you. You graduated last year from the medical assistant program, but I'm wondering, what was it like completing school and then entering the workforce while you're in a pandemic?
Well, to be honest with you, it was kind of hard because people were looking for people with experience. Since we were in the middle of a pandemic, a lot of clinics were not hiring because of the same situation. But thank God I was actually able to get into the job that I'm working right now, into a family medicine practitioner office. So I'm pretty lucky, actually.
Wow. So you were able, right after school, to be able to just to get right into a job.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what's it been like this past year for you?
Well, it has been really rough, mostly because of the pandemic. Because we were having like a really, really low flow of work during work. And we actually had to stop like for 2 months. That was the during June and July of last year, because the pandemic was just really bad during that time. So yeah, we had to stop for 2 months actually, not working. Yeah.
Do you have any friends or do you know anybody who, you know, had to stop school because of the pandemic, or they're having to rethink their lives?
Yes, actually, a lot of my classmates, as far as I know, they drop off school because they didn't like the online classes. They didn't feel it like it will help them in any type of way taking that online classes than presence classes. So they just decide to drop off school.
Wow. You know, Anthony, we're talking about all colleges are feeling it. They're feeling the pinch. The enrollment is down. I'm wondering, what are you hearing from folks, about their options right now? And are technical schools still, do they still see that as the better option?
Well, absolutely, Lewis. From my end, the community is getting more excited about technical colleges. And that's for a couple of reasons. Number one, you get to hear stories like Jasmine, who successfully completed a course and immediately started working. And we don't take that lightly. That's the message that we're giving to the community at large, that you can get a high-paying skill job locally right in your area and start working shortly after completing a certification. And so with that hope, Lewis, and with the message being targeted to our community, a lot of people seem to be taking advantage of that. Also, there's a couple of other reasons. And one reason is that America really don't have a lot of money to be loaning out to students. And then number two, we come in to find out the reason why a lot of people are in the Black community are dropping out of school is because there are no jobs once they get a degree with a whole lot of debt. And so it just makes more sense in this day and age to get a technical college where you can get it in a short period of time, some of them even 4 months to a year, and then start working with no debt. So that's what we're seeing, Lewis, in our community.
You know, you're taking a very interesting approach to recruiting now. You're going door to door. How does that work?
Well, you know, I can say that our company is highly relevant, and we have a respected brand that excites the community. We use hip and engaging messages. We use hip-hop music and popular music genre to educate, inspire, and entertain. And what we've added to that is door-to-door canvassing. You know, a lot of times people don't want to know how much you know. They want to know how much you care. And when you show up to their door with the opportunity, we seem to find that very effective in opening up the doors to having a decent conversation about technical college and how they can get enrolled.
And what are you hearing from people? I'm wondering what those conversations are like when you knock on the door and you get started. You know, what are the typical questions, the things that people are telling you?
Well, I mean, they're asking questions. How long does it take? How much does it cost? You know, the cost is the number one thing that people are concerned about. How much does it cost? How long does it take? And what kind of job can I get? So those are the pretty much the core of the questions. It's not a lot of technical stuff that's going on in no deep conversations. You know, people want to know how fast, when can I start working, and how much money I'm going to get paid, because people are more concerned about that than going to the traditional way of getting a degree and then having to work at the bottom scale because you don't have no experience. It's like we have to rethink our whole way of this educational system, and we believe that technical colleges is opening up the door to that.
Yeah, and I mean, there's been a lot of reporting on, you know, for-profit colleges and that sometimes that lack of credibility when you get a degree delivered from these institutions, you get a lot of debt, and there's not always that promise that there's something on the other side. But, you know, how do you explain to them the differences between, if they don't know, the difference between going to a technical college and just a for-profit school, besides the time of, you know, it may take? What else do they ask? Or what else do you tell them?
Well, my personal story, Lewis, I'm a proud graduate of Lindsay Hopkins Technical College, and I'm also a proud graduate of D.A. Dorsey Technical College. Today, I'm an entrepreneur, a business owner, and a community activist, and I'm doing pretty good. I mean, obviously, I still have a lot of growth in my personal life and my professional life, but I use my own personal story. And let me tell you something, Lewis, it's nothing like peer-to-peer advertisement, peer-to-peer marketing, and peer-to-peer. When you can identify and relate a message to people where they can understand it, it's a different conversation. And so peer-to-peer advertising and marketing with people who have lived experience, Lewis, is the best strategy, in my own personal opinion. And I think Miami-Dade Technical College, Mr. Luis Diaz, Mr. Montella, also the Office of Economic Opportunity, and all of the staff with Miami-Dade Technical College who have an innovative approach to increasing their enrollment.
Mm. Again, we're talking with Anthony King Blackman, founder of Blackman Music Group. He's also working with Miami-Dade Technical Colleges. And we've got Jasmine Dominguez. She's a recent graduate from D.A. Dorsey Technical College. And again, talking about how colleges across the country seeing a decline in enrollment. So what are the implications that could have on the economy, on higher education, and what are the options? And here we're looking at technical colleges as possibly one of those options. You can find more about this story, by the way, on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Jasmine, after graduating, you're still interested in furthering your education. What are your plans for the future? Jasmine, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, Jasmine, what are your plans for the future?
Yeah, so I'm planning to actually go to the bridge program that Miami-Dade College has available for medical assistant students and LPNs. That is for registered nurse. It just take about like 2 years and you get that degree as a registered nurse.
Mm. And so, I mean, for you, the reason you're doing it is why? Would it give you a better opportunity?
Yeah, definitely. It can open me more doors of opportunities to work in hospitals and to just move a little bit more to the goal that I planning to be a registered nurse.
Okay. And I mean, just real quickly, I'm wondering, when do you think you're going to be able to start that and how long would it take?
So as far as I know, it takes a maximum of 14 months for that bridge program and maximum 2 years if you have like a part-time student.
Gotcha. So if people came to you and said, though, listen, I don't have enough time or enough money, the path you took before, you would say to them, it was a good path or no?
Yes, I will absolutely recommend the technical college. Is a really good way to start off. And as Mr. Blackman said, that is a good option if you don't want to end up with a debt, but you want to move on in life. Because you have to start off with something, you know, like, it's not enough just to say that I want to do this, I want to do that, I wanted to gain more money, or I want to be in a different path of life. But if you don't move yourself to actually achieve those dreams, so it's a really good option to start off with whatever path that you want to take afterwards.
Yeah. Again, Jasmine Dominguez, recent graduate from D.A. Dorsey Technical College. We also heard from Anthony King Blackman, founder of Blackman Music Group. He's working with Miami-Dade Technical Colleges. And if you want to learn more about him and what he's up to, just find him on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Anthony and Jasmine, thank you so much. Anthony, great to hear from you again.
Yes, sir. Have a great one.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. And by the way, you can always stay in touch with us via text. Just join our Sundial Text Club. Type the word hello to 786-677-0767. That's again, just type hello to 786-677-0767 and let us know what you think. Maybe you hear a segment like this and you think, wait a second, I'm thinking about my future and you want to know more. That's a great way to connect with us. We might be able to help you out there. Well, still to come. 3 years ago, a local immigration attorney visited a detention center in Texas. Have things gotten any better under President Biden? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Tens of thousands of immigrants are kept in detention facilities across the United States, awaiting their opportunity for asylum cases to be heard. Just last week, the Biden administration closed two ICE jails following reports of poor medical treatment and violation of the civil rights of detainees. The experience of a mother held in immigrant detention in Texas is told in powerful detail in this month's Sundial Book Club selection of Women in Salt. Now, you can listen back to our interview with author Gabriela Garcia last week. Now, while that character is fictionalized, Garcia's story was created because, well, she herself has experience visiting detention facilities. Joining us now is Gina Polo, an immigration attorney with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney in Miami. Polo visited an immigrant detention facility in Texas and worked firsthand with those seeking asylum. Gina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, remind our listeners of the Carnes facility in Texas that you visited several years ago. How do you describe that? How do you describe the place?
It's very much like you would think of a jail, a very low security jail. So there are, you know, guards obviously and restrictions to get in and metal detectors. So it's very much like a jail. I personally didn't find it to be terribly oppressive, or I didn't feel like it was unsafe, but it's very much like a jail in that sense.
Now, you were preparing detained immigrants for credible fear interviews. Explain what those are and why they're important. They're part of the asylum process.
Right. So when a person comes into the United States and presents themselves at a port of entry, if they express a fear of returning to their home country, they're provided what's called a credible fear interview. So that's a process by which an immigration officer determines whether or not the person has a claim, a potential claim to asylum. And then if they do, they're allowed to remain in the United States and present their case before an immigration judge. So it's very important because if they don't understand what the more important factors are for them to explain to that officer, the officer may not know that the person does have a claim to asylum and they're sent back to, you know, possibly have their lives in danger.
You know, what types of answers are judges typically looking for, you know, to grant that asylum?
So it has to be that the person has suffered past persecution or has a credible fear of future persecution based on one of the bases of asylum in the United States. So if they have suffered persecution based on race, religion, nationality, social group, things of that sort, then they are allowed the opportunity to seek asylum before a judge.
I found this fascinating. There was a Stanford Law Review study from 2010, and it found in the same Miami courtroom, by the way, one judge approved 88% of Colombian asylum seekers, while another only 5%. Is the process relatively straightforward, or will you see a lot of variability depending on which judge is sitting there?
There is a lot of variability. It's a human decision as any other when it comes to the legal system. So a lot of it is dependent on the judge, and a lot of it is also dependent on the attorney and how the case is prepared and presented to that judge. So in fairness, it's both. It's the judge and what that person's, you know, maybe ideas or notions of are about that particular country and the person's claim, but also how it's presented to him or her.
Do you get to know who the judge is ahead of time, or do you find out when you show up?
No, you find out ahead of time. And there's more than one hearing. So when you are in an asylum hearing, you're going to go first to a master calendar hearing, which is the equivalent to an arraignment in the criminal context. And then you'll be set for an individual hearing several months in advance if the person's not detained. So you know ahead of time.
Have you experienced that kind of dramatic difference in the courtroom between judges?
There is quite a difference, yes, in general in immigration, not just with asylum, but, you know, as with anything else, when a judge has the discretion as to whether or not they think that a person is deserving of the opportunity to remain in the United States or whether their fear is genuine or credible, there is a great variation from one judge to another.
How do you advise immigrant families, once they're approved for asylum, what the next step is in the process?
So once they're approved, they can apply for permanent residence or adjustment of status, as it's called, a year after. So you have to advise them about the importance of, under no circumstances should they go back to the country from which they fled for obvious reasons. And then to remember to file that application for adjustment a year after, because if they don't file that, they're never going to get the green card, even if they've been granted asylum by a judge.
Again, I'm speaking with Gina Polo. She's an immigration attorney with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney in Miami. As part of her pro bono work, she's assisted detained immigrants in Texas seeking asylum. Now, I mentioned earlier that this month's Sundial Book Club selection of Women in Salt explores some stories of one story in particular of a Miami woman being held in detention in Texas. And you can hear more of our conversation on that. Just go to WLRN.org/sundial. So, Gina, have conditions going back to the Texas facility that you went to, do you know if things gotten any better under a new administration, a new president?
There are definitely some changes that have taken place. I can't speak specifically to the facility at Carnes because I've not had the opportunity to revisit since I was there in 2018. But there are several changes that have taken place since the new administration took over. So, for example, the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP program, that was started in 2019 was a program where migrants that were coming to the United States and seeking asylum were forced to remain in Mexico while their proceedings were pending before immigration courts here in the United States. So on January 21st, that program was suspended by the new administration, and they're now putting in a system as of February where they're triaging, as they call it, 25,000 or so people that are on the that were on the MPP program in Mexico to determine, first and foremost, are they not a threat to national security? If they are not, what are the discretionary factors they're going to use to then process these folks through ports of entries in Texas and California so they can come into the United States and have their asylum claims heard here in the States rather than staying in Mexico?
I mean, we keep hearing about this influx of children from migrant families being detained in the U.S.-Mexico border. But is the system right now overwhelmed? Is it that much?
It is a lot. You know, in all fairness, it is a lot for CBP to handle in terms of the number of children and of people in general that are coming in across the border. I don't know that the numbers that we're seeing right now, honestly, are that much different than in years past. I'm not sure that it's really a huge, massive influx of people, that it's a lot more than in years past, but it is a lot for them to undertake. And when you're talking about children in particular, there are limitations and there are requirements that the government has to abide by in terms of housing and who takes care of them and providing them with their basic needs, reuniting them with family. So it is a very, very difficult situation that's being encountered on the border.
As far as we know, it's more than 22,000 immigrants remain in ICE detention facilities as of last week. Advocates have called on the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to close 39 facilities that are in deteriorating conditions. In your work in immigration law, have you heard of alternatives to these sorts of facilities where we could send them?
Yeah, there are definitely alternatives to detention. So often people are placed on ankle monitor programs where they're released, but they're allowed to, you know, to live in the United States, but they're not housed, so that the cost is not borne by the taxpayer. So there are definitely alternatives. And in February, the new administration issued a memo where they detailed the enforcement and removal proceedings priorities for the new administration of who is going to be detained, who's not going to be detained, under what circumstances, and things of that sort, taking into account, first and foremost, national security, border security, public safety. So, you know, you don't have to keep people in detention. There are alternatives that I've seen the government in my career anyway use.
And the process altogether, you know, when you're going through seeking asylum, how long can it take?
If you're in detention, it could be relatively quick, because obviously the government doesn't want to house you forever if you're in detention, so that asylum claims are processed relatively quickly there, at least the initial hearings. If you're not in detention, I mean, I have a client personally that has been in proceedings, I want to say, for 4 years, and his next hearing was postponed a few months ago, and he's set for September of 2022.
Is it just we don't have enough judges to do this? Would that?
That's definitely a big part of it. Is, yeah, it's the volume of people that are in removal proceedings versus the number of judges that there are in the United States. COVID also obviously had a huge impact because they weren't able to hear cases. And also because during the past 4 years in the previous administration, there was not a priority in terms of who are we going to place in removal proceedings. So if somebody got pulled over and they happened to be here unlawfully, they don't have a driver's license, there was no system by which that person maybe is not an enforcement priority, so we don't initiate proceedings against them. It was everyone. So the system was overloaded with the numbers of people that were being put into proceedings.
So this was a key issue for President Biden and Vice President Harris when they campaigned. Are you optimistic that not only conditions, but maybe also the process might be improved over these next few years?
I am an eternal optimist, so yes, I am optimistic.
Okay.
The things that I've seen in terms of the priorities memo, and also they've implemented as of March a new case review process where you contact your local detention removal and basically lobby on behalf of your client as to why they're not an enforcement priority and why the government should take some sort of action to either terminate the proceedings against them or do something in their favor because they're not a priority for the country.
Gina Polo, she's an immigration attorney with Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney in Miami. Gina, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for the insight.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we'll have more on this story. And again, as we mentioned, because it was part of the Sundial Book Club, just go to our Facebook page, look up Sundial Book Club, and learn more about the book. But more on this story, too, on our website at WLRN.org. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, May 25th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Governor Ron DeSantis signed a controversial new law yesterday that fines social media companies that have barred political figures from using their platforms. Companies like Facebook and Twitter could be fined hundreds of thousands of dollars a day. We're going to explore the First Amendment ramifications of this new law. Plus, a panel conversation with high school seniors talking about their future. We'll hear from students from Palm Beach County, Broward, and Miami-Dade. Parents, we want to hear from you. What's your plan for college next fall? Are your kids leaving the nest? Or are they going to stay home? Remember, text the word hello to 786-677-0767. That's 786-677-0767. Can't wait to hear from you on tomorrow's conversation. And we mentioned for the month of May, we've been reading the book of Women and Salt. Listen back to our interview with Gabriela Garcia on our website, WLRN.org/sundial. For the month of June, we'll be reading the novel, get ready, write it down, Key Lime Crime by Roberta Islieb. There are copies available at libraries across the region. The interview will be coming up in June. Again, Key Lime Crime. Look it up. That's the book for June. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.